You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 21st, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, we're back.
We're back, last day of summer.
Oh, really?
Yes, yeah. It is.
Oh,
we are now officially heading into the bottom half of the analemma. The next six months,
nice.
Go through darkness.
So today's the equinox.
Yes.
True or false, you can stand an egg on its end on the equinox.
False.
True.
False.
No, it's true. But you can do it any other day of the year, too.
Eggs.
Oh, you jerk.
Question, Steve.
When is daylight savings?
The
opposite.
Sunday, 2 a.m. after Halloween.
The Candy Lobby had them move it till after Halloween, so they sell more candy. That's literally true.
That's amazing. Wow. Is it so that kids can, like, trick-or-treat later?
Yeah, that's
correct.
It.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. I kind of dig that. I'm okay with it.
They should just ditch it already. It's such a waste.
Well, I know. It's stupid anyway. The fact that it's so arbitrary means, cool, let us trick-or-treat longer.
So before we get started, we have to ask our listeners for a favor. We're working on a special project. We'll give you more information about that as it proceeds. But we need you to send us questions. There are two types of questions we need you to send us. One is a question that you think we cannot answer. Obviously a science, skeptical, critical thinking type question. But if there's a question you think that for whatever reason, you think that we won't be able to really give an answer to that question, we need you to send that to us. And the second kind of question is there some kind of scientific idea or concept or principle that you've never been able to understand and you've never heard explained in a way that really made you grasp it? So send that to us too. That's sort of a challenge for us to explain a scientific concept in a way that is understandable, specifically one that you've never been able to understand before.
And please send those to info@theskepticsguide.org with the subject, special project.
Yeah.
That makes me ask, like, wonder, do you guys have any scientific concepts in your mind that are just, have always been a little bit of a black box? Like, even when you work to understand them, they always still confuse you a little bit?
Nope.
None. You just understand everything.
Bob's got
of
it
course.
All.
Yes. Well, when I try to understand theoretical physics,
sure.
There is a time when I have to just start pretending like I get it, right? So I'm like talking to Brian Weck.
Go with the flow.
And Brian's getting into it, and I understand the first few sentences. And Brian is a brilliant science communicator, but it gets to a point where it's too, you have to know too much to understand what's coming out of his mouth at a certain point. And then I just pretend like I get it. And I'm like, yes, very interesting. You know what I mean? Like, what are you doing?
That makes sense. Yeah. We were like, I need like 7 more hours with you, Brian. Yeah. He's like, no, thanks.
No, it's more when the math gets way over my head. You
right.
know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can understand it conceptually, but there are some things, especially with like physics, where it really is a math concept and there really isn't a good way to boil it down to that somebody can understand it who doesn't really get the math itself.
But there's nothing more simple, more central. Like for me, probably one of the hardest things to grasp when I was still in school and still to this day, I just kind of look at it like it's a given, but it's a little magic to me, is magnetism. Like mm-hmm. it's still a little like magic to me. You know, there's like, and some people say that about viruses too.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's some magic to them, you know. Of course, it's all explainable, but there's still this bit of a black box.
Kara,
that
the insane clown posse thinks that magnets are magic, right?
Do they?
Yeah, you don't know that song. They wrote a song.
No. They're like, how do they work?
Yeah. Yeah, how do they? Like it's you
that
know, it's,
is hilarious.
It's a miracle, so therefore God exists. You know,
well, Kara, in order to understand magnets, you have to understand how fields work. And I do
yes.
agree that
ooh.
That is one of those concepts that I don't think is often done justice. You know,
no.
if you
especially in school.
Yeah, if you don't wrap your head around fields, then you're not going to understand, you know, the discussion about things like magnets.
And also right. electricity is tied up in that because they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And the whole picture isn't often offered. It's like these weird little snippets and then you're left to try and connect them all later.
Yeah.
Speaking of fields, for me, it's the Higgs field. Yeah. That's mm-hmm. a very recent concept for me, and I still don't know that I fully understand it. I sort of take Bob at his word.
As you should.
All right, well, hit us with the toughest questions you can, and we'll see what we could do with them. All right, Bob, you haven't done a forgotten superhero in a few weeks, so hit us with
yeah. that. We are due, and this week I am discussing Mary Elizabeth Barber, 1818 to 1899. Just missed the new century. She was a pioneering amateur scientist who, without formal education, became a noted plant collector and natural historian, and even conferred with eminent English biologists of the day, including Charles Darwin. Now, Barber moved at age 2 with her family to Cape Colony, South Africa, and spent her life there. Her and her brothers all loved natural history since they were little, but when she saw and read the book, The Genera of South African Plants, Arranged According to the Natural System by botanist William Henry Harvey, her life's career was pretty much set. She just fell in love with it. So she loved observing flora and fauna and was constantly contributing to the botanical sciences and sending unknown species that no one had seen before to naturalists all over the world. She even had plants named after her, like the aloe barbare, which is an aloe tree. But she also loved entomology as well, specifically moths and butterflies. And her observations were so keen, in fact, that she actually influenced some of Darwin's thoughts on moths and orchid pollination. But she not only communicated with him, she was totally plugged in to the network of leading naturalists all over and was fairly influential. Her efforts and talents got her invited to become a member of the South African Philosophical Society, which was at that time in the 1800s an incredible honor for a woman to be invited. I think she was the first. She had a great quote regarding this invitation. She said, "I have no objection. And I don't see any reason why a lady should, in a quiet way, be a member of any scientific society. I do not by any means approve of ladies coming publicly forward and usurping the places of men by preaching, making speeches, etc. But I don't see why they should not belong to any society that they are qualified for and in a quiet way enjoy the privileges too." So all of this, not too bad for a woman in the 1800s with no formal training in her chosen scientific career. So remember Mary Elizabeth Barber, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing photoautotrophs, chemotrophs, and heterotrophs.
Mm-hmm. Like you do.
Yeah.
So Bob, did you like that quote because you don't like being usurped?
I do love that word, but I do like when she said about how, you know, if they're qualified, that's all that really should matter. Nothing else should really matter. So that was a nice sentiment. And in the 1800s, I mean, you know, even a little daring.
Yeah, you can still see that it echoed of the times, right? She's like, be ladylike about it, but take your place. You know, like, don't piss the guys off, but like, show them that you deserve to be there, which I get, you know, it was necessary.
All right, Jay, you're going to start us off with the news items with one of our favorite animacules, one of the, I think, unofficial mascots of the SGU.
You know what I love about these little guys is that I just found another name that they're called. I'm talking about tardigrades. And they're also known as water bears.
Water bears, baby.
Roar.
Bob, listen to this one. A moss piglet.
Oh, my God.
Oh, so cute.
My God, that's perfect
that makes
for
sense.
Them.
I know,
it's
right?
perfect for them. Holy crap. Where'd you hear that one?
I read it. You know, the thing that bothers me is I've read about these guys many, many times. Like, why did it take today, 2016, for me to read that? So anyway, another cool way to describe these guys is they're micro animals, which I think is an interesting classification. These guys live in water, and there's about 1,000 different species of tardigrades, and they all have 8 legs, and they're all resilient, and some of those species are incredibly resilient. Yeah, and they can live through pretty much, you know, the most serious changes in the environment that you can think of. They could shake off boiling and freezing temperatures, radiation, outer space. They can survive desiccation. You know, you get the idea. Like these little buggers can live anywhere that you can imagine, except probably in the mouth of a volcano. But I'd like to know. They were first found by a German zoologist named Johann August Ephraim Goes in 1773, and they didn't get their proper name tardigrada until 3 years later by an Italian biologist, Iazzaro Spallanzani. and the word tardigrada means slow stepper.
Ha!
Cool, right?
Yeah, well, what is that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tardigrade, yeah.
So they're found in the deep sea to mountaintops and in all extreme environments like the Antarctic and, you know, I guess some are floating in outer space. You never know.
Which they can survive, by the way.
That's correct. I know, right? Like, come on. You could go to the bottom of the ocean and survive in outer space. You're a badass. I don't care how small you are.
They are completely awesome. But as a point of clarification, they are not extremophiles. They don't like these extreme environments. They are extremotolerant. They can survive them. And the most extreme environments, like vacuum, high temperatures, very low temperatures, they survive these only in their desiccated state. So their main adaptation, or one of them, is that they can be completely dried out, and then when water returns, they can come back to life. And while they're dried out, they're extremotolerant. They could survive these extreme environments. But they're not puttering around in space. They're not, you know, they're only dry little husks when they're surviving in those kinds of environments.
According to the results published in the journal Nature Communications, recently scientists sequenced their genome and have found out how they're so resilient, which I've been wanting to know for a long time. They studied the tardigrade species that's most stress tolerant, the Ramazatoius verandorinatus, which is mostly accurate, by the way I pronounced it. These guys evolved to handle harsh environments in part by losing bits of their DNA that trigger cells to react to the environment by creating things like hydrogen peroxide molecules, which is crazy, but that's what cells do to, I guess, in just plain reaction to extreme environment change. So, of course, cells are damaged by those molecules. And on the flip side, the tardigrade genome developed protein protective genes. And these new proteins preserve the delicate strands of DNA from breaking, right? And, of course, when DNA strands break, that's when cells can do bad things and die, and, you know, and also create new cells that are screwed up with wrong DNA. Amazingly, when these proteins were introduced into human kidney cells, the new cell line was capable of surviving X-ray radiation and hydrogen peroxide much better than normal unchanged cells by about 40%, which I thought was remarkable.
Where can I get some of those cells?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's that may be the real story here is mm-hmm. that – so first of all, a couple of things. One is on a previous show, we talked about a science or fiction where a large percentage of the tardigrade genome was actually horizontal transfer. And later
– Yeah,
that was not replicated. Later, you know, studies did not back that up. So that is probably wrong and at least controversial. And I think this study also doesn't support that. They thought that the, you know, their resistance to radiation was just very robust DNA repair, but now they know it's actually the DNA is wrapped in this protein that protects it, shields it from radiation. And it, at least in this one study with human kidney cells, they introduced the protein into those cells and it works on human cells too. So could you imagine if we can, you know, genetically engineer people, let's say, or figure out a way to get these proteins in every cell in your body.
Amazing. They'd make good candidates for space exploration.
Absolutely.
That's for sure.
That's the first thing I thought of, is we got to give these proteins to our astronauts and reduce their cumulative X-ray damage. You know,
it may also reduce our cancer risk if we do. I mean, it probably would reduce our cancer risk.
Isn't it a little scary, though? You're wrapping all of your DNA in like some armor. I mean, that sounds cool and all, but it's
what
like,
could possibly go wrong?
All your DNA is already wrapped up in these, not in these proteins, but in proteins. It's
histones.
Not like the process of, like it kind of coils and wraps down and coils and wraps down. It has these histone proteins. So it's not like that idea is foreign to our cells or to our nuclear material. It's just, I guess this one's better.
But Bob's point is valid, is that we don't know what other apparatus are necessary for this to work. It may be, we found the one gene for the one protein that is actually protecting the DNA, but it may be part of a whole system that we haven't discovered yet. We're looking at kidney cells in culture. We're not looking at a whole organism.
Right.
So there's a lot of research between now and mutated astronauts. Yeah.
And not just that, Steve. It's not just, you know, what else is needed. you know, what might it interfere with? That's homegrown that we kind of need. That as well is another concern. But
or cause
interesting stuff,
cancer.
Man.
Yeah, it's never as simple as we'd like to think, right? There's always a wrinkle
right.
somewhere.
Yeah, it's never like just eat some water bears and then you'll be resistant to radiation.
Speaking of eating water bears, do they survive the digestion process when other critters eat them?
Well, do water bears live in poop?
Well, wait, hold on. I'll tell you something I found out. That they can survive organic solvents.
But hydrochloric acid?
Well, it blew my mind. I watched a video of one of them actually desiccating, and it shrivels up into, like, nothing. You know, you just see it go from a normal-shaped tardigrade to, like, a little nub, and then that's it. It has no moisture in it, and then they rehydrate it, and he comes back. He's fine. Ah!
And you could rehydrate it a century later, and it'll come back. A century!
Yeah. So these things are going to be around, I think, a lot longer than people will on the Earth.
Oh, yeah. They're like the new cockroach.
Yeah, they kick cockroaches' asses.
So looking up very quickly, it sounds like stomach acid would kill tardigrades. They don't survive digestion.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That actually
I'm
makes
very
sense.
Disappointed in them now.
So there's one environment they haven't mastered yet. So we just have to eat them all and
incorporate their proteins into our own body, and then we'll be super mutants.
That has to be a comic book.
Tardigrade Man?
Somebody has to make Water Bear Man.
Moss Piglet Man.
All you do is take the story of the fly, 1985's version, you put it in a transportation pod, tardigrade and human, boom, you are all set. Oh,
so cool.
What a good movie.
It was a good movie.
Well, Kara, we're going to go from super water bears to super lice. Not as fun. Not as fun a story, but tell us about this.
Yeah, when I first came across this in my feed reader, my full reaction was gross. That's like just all I could think about. So basically, some researchers just published a study this month in pediatric dermatology where they wanted to look at lice infestations in the United States and combine all the literature that's available between 1985 and 2014 and see kind of what the state of lice treatment is. And in focusing on all of this different literature, they were able to come up with 579 studies. They mostly focused on a handful of different types of treatments. There's lindane, which is also known as Y-hexachlorocyclohexane. There is pyrethrins and permethrin. These are collectively the pyrethroids. And these are the things that we probably remember or can think about having been on the shelf and still are, like Rid or Nix, those over-the-counter treatments. And then there's also malathion, which uses isopropyl alcohol, benzyl alcohol, and another treatment called spinosad. Also topical ivermectin. So if anybody has ever dealt with a louse infestation, and specifically it was bad enough that they had to go get a prescription medication, everything I just mentioned is prescription, except for the OTC drugs, the pyrethroids I mentioned, which are Nix and Rid. Okay, so here's what they found. Basically, these over-the-counter treatments used to work, and now they don't.
Yeah, drug resistance.
Yeah. And so there's a few different reasons for that. One is that they have been over the counter for so long. They first popped up on shelves in the early 80s. And at the time that they were first available, early literature from that sort of time span showed a really, really high rate of treatment effectiveness, like 99%, 100%, 96%, like pretty high in lots of regions of the United States. Then towards the 90s, you start to see a big slip and things start to break down into the 60s, 50s, 40-something percentiles. And then by 2009 up to 2014, these pyrethroids are functioning closer at 25% effectiveness, which is indistinguishable at that point from placebo. Now, obviously, we know about drug resistance. We know how it works in bacteria. Lice are, you know, organisms actually slightly more complex, actually pretty a lot more complex than bacteria. And they've been able to develop these kinds of resistances as well. But there's also an added wrinkle, which is that specifically NIT and RID, these permethrin and pyrethrin compounds, bind to the same receptor site as DDT. So there's an idea that possibly because of the intense spraying of DDT, if you guys remember in the early 90s, I think it was, that might have actually contributed to the treatment resistance of these lice, in addition to kind of the usage of these over-the-counter drugs sort of willy-nilly. Also, because as their effectiveness started to go down over the course of those decades, people would often use multiple treatments. They would just keep going back to the grocery store and buying another box.
It's accelerating the process.
Yeah, especially in that core population.
It didn't work the first time. Let's do it again.
Yeah, but you know what? The reason for that is that some of the treatments that are available over the counter do require two different doses. It makes sense. Because if you look at the lifestyle of a louse, it's pretty gross. So their whole life happens on a host. So you get head-to-head contact, either from like giving somebody a close hug, you know, being very close and your hair touching and them physically going like across to your hair, or sometimes from sharing things. You know, it seems to be that the jury's out whether or not sharing brushes and wearing the same hats fully contributes. Reasonably it does contribute, but there are some pediatricians who say, like, don't freak out about that. Like, you're probably going to get it from your significant other or from your children if you live in close proximity anyway. But the way that they work are that there's an egg that's laid really close to the scalp. The female actually secretes a cement, like a protein cement, and it like glues the egg to your shaft. So it's actually very hard. Like, just shampooing won't take it out.
Your shaft?
Hair shaft, Bob.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. These are head lice. We're talking about head lice. Just head lice. And so then those eggs hatch in 7 to 10 days. And then the nymph starts to feed actually within a single minute after hatching. And they're able to reproduce within 24 hours. So you basically have this span of around 11 days from egg to reproduction. And a lot of these prescription treatments actually don't affect the eggs. They only affect mature lice. So you actually have to do two treatments in an effort to get the whole life cycle out of your hair. There's also some other recommendations that came out from reading all these different studies and compiling all this data. One of them is that they don't recommend lindane, or as I mentioned, Y-hexachlorocyclohexane. It was first registered in the 50s. It's a GABA inhibitor, and it's also already been banned in California. It has a lot of side effects, and the box label warning says that it can even cause death, even at the recommended dosage. And it's not to be used in infants, in young children, in immunosuppressed individuals, in elderly adults, in individuals weighing less than 110 pounds. Basically, everyone who gets lice. Yeah, exactly. Half the population, and people who are most at risk of getting lice, like children. The toxicity just makes it so that it's not worth it except as a last ditch. But other things, like I mentioned before, malathion, which is an insecticide that works on lice, benzyl alcohol, and spinosad. And also there's a topical called ivermectin. Those all seem to work, and they seem to work relatively well. Some for kind of on average in the 60th to 70th to 80th percentile of effectiveness in a single treatment. Some of them require two treatments. A couple more random things I found out. One, the American Medical Association or the Association of Pediatrics within the American Medical Association do not say, or they say that combing out nits is not necessary in order to get rid of your lice. It's a lot of people just do it, I don't want to say for vanity reasons, but because they don't like the look. And two, they don't recommend keeping your kids home from school, which is quite interesting.
Wow.
They don't think that that's sufficient. And actually, one of the biggest problems with lice is not that it really is clinically significant, in the sense it doesn't cause a lot of lasting damage. It's not really that dangerous, but it causes a lot of missed school.
So, Kara, there's been a few studies recently which points to what may be the most effective treatment for lice, and that is hairdryer.
Hairdryer. Oh, interesting. Or shaving your head.
Well, shaving your head, definitely.
Why is that?
But hairdryer 30 minutes a day for 14 days to cover the entire life cycle, as you say, is 98.3% effective. It essentially works. If you do it enough, it'll work. It kills almost all the eggs and like 80% of the adults, mainly through desiccation. And you could do that even with a regular home hairdryer. You know, doesn't have to be anything special.
Yeah, I would assume that you would want to be, it's probably the tough thing about that is if you're an adult and you get lice, sure, that's a great treatment. And if you're a child and you're old enough to blow dry your own hair, but I would be afraid. I mean, you tell me, you guys are the parents. If you have a young child, to sit there with 30 minutes with a blow dryer on their head and not burn them.
Right, I know. Like, that just seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it's probably reasonable, but yeah, you would have to be really vigilant while you do that for sure.
Sure, but considering the options of when you have a kid with lice, that's not a bad one.
Oh, no. For sure. I mean, it's free. It's a free option.
Yeah.
And,
well, almost free, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, most people probably do have a hairdryer in their home somewhere.
Oh, it works really well. Yeah. But I do think that we should have a worldwide shave all the hair on your body day, where every human like being alive shaves all their hair, and then we eradicate lice in one generation.
So, Steve, really, if you shave all your hair off, that's it. They're gone.
Well, yeah, they live on hair. So
their whole life cycle is in head hair. Yeah. Their entire life cycle. They don't live in your cats. They don't live in your dogs. They live in your human
head hair.
All right,
I would do it. I'd do that for the planet, sure.
Yeah, it'd be easy for most of the guys out there to say.
Yeah, but then there's going to be a few people who don't think that it'll work.
There'll be some anti-shavers.
Haircutting deniers.
The anti-shavers, man, would ruin it for everybody.
That's right. We're trying to do herd, population control here of
the
lice.
It's a big conspiracy.
Yeah, 10% of us are going to ruin it for the 90%. Ugh.
And then I will have shaved my head in vain.
Right.
Terrible. Well, I wonder where the herd immunity falls with that.
Yeah, how many do you have to eradicate so that they can't?
Doesn't spread.
So that they only live in pockets and then die off, yeah.
Yeah, maybe if 90% would be enough. Okay, well, we have kind of an unintentional theme this week because I'm going to be talking about bacteria. We're talking about small critters.
Small things.
Yeah.
Micro
and resistance.
Have you guys seen this research that's been going around? The researchers at Harvard made this really massive plate, auger plate, that you grow bacterial colonies on.
This was awesome.
Yeah.
The video was fantastic.
They made it so that at the outside of the plate, there was no antibiotic, and then they had increasing concentration in layers. You know, like you would reach a certain barrier, then there would be a tenfold increase in the concentration of antibiotics that would exist for a while. Then as you get closer to the middle, it would be higher and higher and higher until you had 1,000 times a lethal dose, you know, for the non-resistant bacteria in the middle of the plate. And then they, you know, plated bacteria and filmed them growing. The purpose of this was to see the pattern of the evolution of antibiotic resistance. And it was fascinating. So you could see the bacteria growing up to the dividing line to the next higher concentration of bacteria. And then colonies would break out. You know, you could see that that's where a mutation happened because then it would start spreading into the next layer. And it would happen in multiple locations. And then they would push up against the next boundary layer. And then again, multiple individual colonies would break out into this subsequent layer. It was cool. It's really fun to watch.
It's literally evolution visualized.
Yeah. So it's a way of visualizing the pathways of mutations that the bacteria evolved in sequence to allow them to survive higher and higher concentrations of antibiotics. So it's very, very clever. Now, the researchers were interested in looking at some particular subtleties, you know, and I think a lot of the news reporting focused on the big picture, which is, I think, appropriate. I mean, they weren't trying to prove evolution, but, you know, hey, by the way, this is a cool demonstration of evolution. But what they were looking for was the pattern of growth. So one of the hypotheses was that the most resistant bacteria would exist on the leading edge of colonies as they spread into the higher concentration zones. But they found that wasn't the case, that often the more resistant bacteria were essentially trapped behind less resistant bacteria, if that makes sense. And so the leading edge was not always comprised of the most resistant bacteria. But anyway, so there were subtleties like that they were looking for. That was interesting. But yeah, the response to this was to me the most interesting thing. So Michael Behe, you guys know who this guy is, right?
Oh, yeah.
He's one of the people who's trying desperately to make intelligent design a respectable science. He's failing. He's utterly failing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his big claim to fame was irreducible complexity, right? The idea that there are some structures or pathways or combinations of metabolic, you know, functions that are irreducibly complex. They cannot function if they were any simpler than a certain, you know, simplicity. And they're too complex to have evolved all at once by chance. So he's trying to prove that evolution's impossible. The problem is that all of his examples have been blown to bits, right? So all of his examples of things that are irreducibly complex, it's been shown that they're not irreducibly complex, that there are simpler versions of them that function. And one of the big concepts that Behe misses is that evolution can take quirky pathways, right? So, like, if you take the flagellum, the bacterial flagellum, like the classic example, and he said, oh, look, it has so like 64 different protein components, and if they're not all in place, it doesn't work as a flagellum. It's like, well, that's not true. There are bacteria that have simpler flagella, but also the flagellum, you know, like the little hair-like tail that some bacteria used to swim, that could have evolved from structures that served another purpose.
Sure.
Yeah, like there are bacteria that have a simplified protein structure that looks similar to a flagellum, but only like the core, and that is used to like inject toxins into nearby cells. So it could have been used for that, and then, you know, it was co-opted to be essentially a clumsy flagellum and then got refined to be a more of a functional flagellum, for example. So that co-optation of a structure for one that evolves for one purpose and then using it for something else, you know, so that you're to have this evolutionary stepping stones. And then, of course, it's hard to reverse engineer because you have to, you know, reverse the pathway of evolution. Sometimes we can infer likely pathways by looking at other creatures. And, of course, fossils, if the feature we're looking at is something that fossilizes. But Behe focuses a lot of attention on things that don't fossilize, you know, like protein pathways. So he's conveniently staying away from the areas where evidence is likely to disprove his claims. But then even still he fails because we can show plausible pathways from comparative anatomy. Anyway.
He's running out of margins to operate with.
So, well.
They're all closed.
Well. His most recent book is called The Edge of Evolution, and he is refining the same basic line of logic further. So now, you know, he essentially acknowledges common descent. He's like, yep, the world's 4 billion years old. Life has been evolving on Earth for 4 billion years. We're all related through common descent, and evolution is happening. So he basically acknowledges pretty much all of evolution.
That's his argument now.
Except, again, he's got to hold out.
Human consciousness?
Well, no. Well,
quantum,
if he can, if he can prove that there's one tiny aspect of evolution that could not happen through natural processes or random processes, then you, that's the God of the gaps, right?
That's it.
You've got to crack open a gap somewhere and say, well, God had to do that. Therefore, God, right? So,
and therefore, God.
Yeah. Therefore, God.
So his holdout. So yeah, I get there are mutations. There's natural selection. It's all good, but there are some things where multiple mutations would have to occur at the same time, and if you calculate the odds of though of like having these multiple mutations all occurring together, there hasn't been enough time in the history of life on Earth for that to happen by chance alone. Therefore, God must be like creating the necessary mutation. So the designer is every now and then will dip his hand in and create like a bunch of mutations and, you know, essentially create a certain bit of complexity all at once, that something that's too complex to have evolved by itself.
Wow.
The problem is that again, he's objectively wrong. And the examples he gives fail, you know, when you actually know what's going on. So one of the things that he looked at was the evolution of resistance to medication in the parasite that causes malaria. The parasite can become resistant to chloroquine, which is the drug that we use to treat it, but it requires two simultaneous mutations. And he said, so that's an example where, yeah, one mutation won't do it, so it needs two. He said, that's the edge of evolution, right? That's the most complex thing that could ever evolve by chance alone. If you need three mutations, forget about it. There's just not enough time in the universe for that to happen.
Does he know how old the Earth is? He does know, right?
No, but he says even with 4 billion years, it's not enough. And he's right in a way. He's right and he's wrong, right? He's correct in that if his premise were true, that these mutations need to occur simultaneously, yeah, the probability of three specific mutations occurring all in one organism is very remote. But he's asking the wrong question. So part of it is, well, so anybody want to hazard a guess at what core logical fallacy he's committing there? Which is kind of same logical fallacy that most intelligent design arguments are based on. It's the lottery fallacy, right? So,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
He's asking, right, what's the probability that John Smith won the lottery? Well, it's 250 million to one against, so it couldn't have happened
for John
by
Smith.
Chance.
The odds that someone would win.
Yes.
Anybody.
That anybody would win ever. Yeah, it actually happens exactly as often as you think it should. In fact, there are people who have won the lottery twice, and the newspapers love to say, oh, the odds of this happening are quadrillion, zillion, billions to one. It's like, yeah, no, not so much. You have to consider that, first of all, this person's bought lots of lottery tickets and participated. You calculated the odds of buying one ticket and winning two successive lotteries on one ticket. How about the guy bought 100 tickets and he's been doing it for 20 years, you know? And so have millions of other people, you know?
And that's, right, and that's the key right there, see, the sheer number of
right
people.
So what the intelligent design proponents miss is that we're not just talking about the probability of parasites evolving resistance to chloroquine. We're talking about the probability of anything occurring in evolution. Think about all the potential things that could possibly evolve.
Oh, gosh.
You know, it's probably infinite. You know what I mean?
It's as close to infinite as you can
probably for all
imagine.
Practical purposes, it's essentially infinite. And so the probability of something very specific evolving may be very low, but the probability of anything evolving is the same as like the probability of someone eventually winning the lottery. It's going to happen. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, but here's another more biological mistake that he makes, in that he's assuming that the organism has to evolve the mutation simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how evolution works, my friend. And we know now that that's – we know empirically, and I'll get to that in a second. So first of all, for his chloroquine example, what we found was that it is true that the parasite needs two mutations, but one of those – two mutations could be one of two possibilities. So it's like you need mutation A and then either B or C.
Oh, that really increases the
possibility. It does increase the possibilities quite a bit. But even then, what we find is that you have different subpopulations of organisms that do genetic drift. Again, creationists always forget about genetic drift, you know?
They don't like
it. Yeah, so they just don't incorporate it into their thinking about evolution because they don't understand evolution. They don't want to understand evolution. Genetic drift means that populations just develop mutations and that some mutations will predominate just because of random chance, right? Drift, it's a good, perfect term. And therefore, you have subpopulations that are going to represent a lot of different possibilities. So all you need is for one strain of parasite to have one of the two mutations by genetic drift. And then within that population of billions of individuals, one of the second mutation crops up and boom, you got resistance.
You got it. Yeah. There it is. It
didn't have to happen simultaneously in one organism. Yeah. Okay. So here's the, you guys remember this, but you know, I want to know if you could think about this. What's the empiric evidence where we know for sure that this happens empirically? And this is
two things in one organism.
Yeah, so
two mutations in one organism.
Yeah, an organism developing a trait that requires multiple mutations, and that is Lenski's bacteria experiments. So this is the guy who spent decades following multiple colonies of bacteria, of E. coli, and seeing if they would evolve the ability to metabolize citrate as a food source, which requires multiple mutations. And and it cropped up pretty much at random in some of the strains. And remember, this is a wonderful experiment because he ran tens of thousands of generations and he would periodically, you know, freeze them. He would save them so that he could go back 20,000 generations or whatever and rerun that line and see what happens the second time around. So it was a beautiful empirical study of evolution. And what he found was that they were able to evolve the ability to eat citrate, basically, even though it required multiple mutations. And that was fine. It didn't have to happen in one bacterium, just that some strains developed one mutation, and then their descendants were, you know, only in that line that developed the first mutation would they then develop the ability to eat citrate, because then they just needed a second mutation and then they would be good. So
yeah, and that happens generations apart. Like, it doesn't have to be simultaneous.
Exactly. It happens generations apart multiple times. Once you get the first mutation, then you have multiple descendant lines develop the second mutation and are good. It doesn't affect the odds of having the second mutation.
Yeah.
You're down to just the odds of the second mutation. The other point that the creationists always miss is that they say, well, you can't have sequential mutations because neither mutation by itself provides any advantage, any survival advantage. Again, that's just getting back to their missing genetic drift. Like, no, you can, one of the mutations can just propagate through the through one part of the population, through one subpopulation at random, and then you're set up for the second mutation. Plus, again, don't make the lottery fallacy. You don't necessarily have to solve this problem in this way. Life solves multiple problems in multiple different ways, takes different paths, and it's hard to even think about all the possible paths it can take. So Behe is just hopelessly wrong because he's working backwards. He's desperately trying to carve out something evolution can't do, therefore God. But he just doesn't make a coherent argument. I bring up Behe also because he commented on this, the giant plate of bacteria, saying it's not evolution, it's devolution, which doesn't exist.
What
the hell is that?
Yeah, so it's
making shit up.
Yeah, it's just making shit up.
You're allowed to do that?
He's saying because it didn't create a new structure, it just broke an enzyme. So first of all, is looking at life as if there's one state that's correct and another state's broken.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's just different, right? We're all mutants. Everything is just is what it is. No, there is no correct or pristine or state or anything. You're not devolving from anything. You're not evolving to anything. It's just local adaptation. So again, he doesn't understand evolution. Creationists do not understand evolution. They're always arguing from their own ignorance.
Yeah, it's like even the concept of a positive, negative, or neutral adaptation is only context specific.
Exactly.
Like, is that positive because it improves the fitness in that organism in this time scale?
Yeah, exactly.
But like, it could be negative on a different planet or at a different, you know, place and time, or if they had different prey. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's so depressing too, because it's like taking these, that's what pseudoscience is. It's taking these slivers of real science and of scientifically like legitimate sounding stuff repackaging it for bullshit agendas.
Yeah. It's like
the trappings of real science.
Science plus motivated reasoning equals pseudoscience.
Yes.
That's often what we're seeing.
Yes.
And that's a t-shirt.
I love it.
Yeah, for sure. Right?
So
that
do
is
you
a t-shirt.
Think, though, when they're researching this information, when they get to a point where they're reading about the science and it's disagreeing with what they need to believe, right? Are they veering away from, you know, I'm trying to figure out like where when they feel cognitive dissonance, are they stopping themselves from reading and continuing the research and kind of just looping back to what they already thought?
No, it's again the motivated reasoning, right? You hit them with an argument and then they channel their thinking in a way that reinforces the conclusion that they want.
It's confirmation bias, pure and simple. They're just picking what satisfies. There's enough out there, and there's enough of it that's like twisted in such a way that you can find your own creative interpretation of the data,
right?
And you just put that into your frame of reference.
Steve, you wrote a very good blog piece on this. I recommend people read it and read the comments, and you'll see what motivated reasoning exactly is.
Yeah, my resident troll, you know, is in there. But that's nothing. Evan, you got to go back a few blog posts. I hit over 1,000 comments with my readers arguing with this guy.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
He's hopeless. He's hopeless. But his amazing. Motivated reasoning is that mutations aren't random. And I'm like, I refer you back to the Lenski experiments, which show that the mutations are random. He actually showed empirically that these mutations are cropping up at random. I mean, you know, it's QED. It's like, there's no evidence for that. There's the evidence. It's right there. You just are not aware of it. Read it. Really absorb the full implications of Lenski's bacterial research. It's a death blow to so many of the creationist arguments. It's amazing.
Maybe that troll has tardigrade cells in him. he just keeps going and going no matter what gets thrown.
He's resistant.
There you go. All right, Bob, I understand there's yet another update about how the moon formed.
Yeah, I totally love this news item. See if you guys like it too. Scientists and engineers have refined the theory of the moon's formation, and it now looks like the Earth had to almost completely be vaporized for the moon to form as it is.
Whoa.
And I don't know, Steve, Jay, maybe you, Steve. I'm sure you remember when we were growing up the theories of how the moon formed. There was a lot of them. There was the captured body idea where the moon just came flinging by and we caught it, which is kind of silly. There's the idea of fission where the rapidly spinning Earth kind of excreted the moon because it was spinning so fast. And that was actually proposed by, guess who? George Darwin, son of Charles Darwin. I did not know that.
Son?
Cool.
Yes. That was really cool. And another theory is the condensation theory, that they just happened to form together. It didn't take long, though. I think it was in the 70s when the giant impact model theory came out, and it made a lot of sense. The idea here is that a Mars-sized planet that they call Theia, or is it Theia? T-H-E-I-A, Theia.
Theia.
Theia is the mother of moon in Greek myth. So Theia was a grazing collision. So it hit us, but not directly head on. So during this grazing collision, it would have probably liquefied part of the Earth's surface and sent it into orbit. And so the moon then would be made up of part of this liquefied surface of the Earth and Theia itself.
And some cheese, right, Bob?
And well, yeah, of course, lots of cheese thrown in there. So that theory made a lot of scientists happy for two reasons primarily. First off, it explained very well the relative sizes of the Earth and the Moon, which is actually, as you know, for a planet-Moon system, it's huge. You could argue that it's actually a double planetary system and not even a Moon. You could make that argument.
Gosh, don't do that.
And it also explains the rotation rate of both bodies, so it was very nice, but it came along with a problem. The giant impact model requires that the moon be mostly made from Theia. Some models even say that it should be 60 to 80% Theia, and that's a big problem. Why? Because of isotopes. If you look at the oxygen isotopes found on the Earth and the Moon, they are identical, and that should not happen, or it should be incredibly unlikely. Because isotopes, we've discussed them on the show, isotopes are essentially subspecies of elements. The elements have the same protons, but a varying degree of neutrons, and some of them are very stable, so you have the different isotopes of the element. And these are fingerprints. These isotopes are fingerprints, and it's believed that a lot of the different bodies, if you were formed in a different part of the solar system, then you were going to have different isotopes and different isotopic ratios. So the idea that we would get hit by a planet like Theia and that we both happen to have the same oxygen isotopes is so incredibly unlikely that the scientists were like, well, that we got to deal with this because that doesn't make sense. So even though this was a huge problem, for years scientists still had hope that eventually we would have these refined techniques that would be developed to find these subtle isotopic differences. But in 2015, those hopes were dashed. They ran their most subtle examinations of these isotopes, and they are identical. Washington University geochemist Kun Wang said in a news release, oh man, that's a funny name. He said, these are the most precise measurements we can make, and they're still identical. So, okay, the gauntlet was thrown down. So the scientists had to rush and try to refine the giant impact model, because the impact model itself was still probably good, but they had to tweak it a little bit to take into account for these isotopic similarities. Or is it isotopic? I'm going to go with isotopic.
I like isotopic.
Yeah.
So they came out with two tweaks. You've got the giant impact low energy hypothesis, and you've got the giant impact high energy hypothesis. Now, the low energy variant here, it's pretty much the same as before. Grazing hit from Theia, but the addition is that it adds the silicate vapor atmosphere that surrounds the Earth, and it's this kind of weird atmosphere thing of debris that transfers material between the Earth and the remnants of Theia, but that has a problem as well. That would just take far too long because the condensation can happen fairly quickly, and it's just not enough time for a thorough mixing to happen. So that one didn't look too good. The other hypothesis, the giant impact high energy one, that one seemed more promising. So this is obviously, it's a much more direct impact. It's not grazing. And that would have been an awesomely nasty event. Imagine this. Most of the Earth would not have just melted. It would have vaporized. And so if it happened, this is what you would have seen. You would have seen the bare core of the Earth. It actually would have stripped away the crust and the mantle, and you have basically just the core of the Earth sitting there. Oh my God. I want to see that.
I want to see that in a movie.
Oh. That is intense. So surrounded by this bare core, you'd have this massive magma atmosphere that would be huge. Magma that would be about 500 times Earth's current volume. So this would be huge. And that would allow a thorough mixing of Earth and Theia. Most of that magma atmosphere then would, of course, rain down on the Earth and recreate our planet. But that part of the magma atmosphere, the outer edges of that atmosphere, would be beyond the Roche limit. That means that it's far enough away in orbit that means that it wouldn't rain down back on Earth, but it would condense, and it then condensed into the moon. So that's the giant impact high energy hypothesis. So the next thing to do then was, of course, to find the evidence to support one of these new hypotheses, and that's exactly what they did. So they did this again by looking at isotopes, but not oxygen this time. They looked at potassium isotopes, specifically potassium 39 and potassium 41. They found that the moon had more of the heavier element potassium 41 than the Earth did. And that's exactly the kind of evidence that they needed. So because if the heavier potassium condensed first, forming the moon, that means that the Earth had to be vaporized and not just melted. And that means that the giant impact high energy hypothesis is supported, not the giant impact low energy hypothesis. So it's looking really good that they finally have a tweaked version of the impact hypothesis that could really account for this. So of course they've got some more work to do, but this one's looking really good. I just wanted to say I love this news item because it shows, it really is a good showcase for the process science go through to refine a theory and then as new evidence rolls in. And that's exactly what they did. So they see this evidence like, well, we've got to deal with this evidence. They're not going to ignore it like a pseudoscientist and stick with their pet theories that make them feel good. They're going to have to deal with this and come up with new models.
All right, Jay, who's that noisy time? It's been a few weeks.
Yeah, long time ago, I played this noisy. So what is that?
A canasta convention.
That is a guy counting all of the patrons in a very, very busy bar.
He's got a little clicker in his hand.
Clicker?
Yeah.
Yeah, so whatever it is, it sounds like it has a hand crank.
Well, you'll notice that there was three different discrete sections in there, and I think I gave a clue last time that they're all the same thing with just different frequency.
Yeah.
So what you're hearing, these are called hydrogel balls, right? These are water-absorbing polymer spheres that are like the size of marbles. And the property that they have is that they can absorb water, and they're used for gardening and things like that because they'll slowly release water over time. But what's cool about these is if you put them into a very hot frying pan, something really cool happens. What you're seeing in the video, if you look this up and watch a video about it, is these balls are just bouncing continuously in the frying pan, and every time one of them touches it, it makes that chirpy noise, right? After doing some digging and trying to figure out the physics of this, what I believe is happening is that the ball, when it touches the hot surface of the frying pan, a small amount of water that's absorbed inside the ball boils. and it bursts out and it shoots the ball up into the air. And then the ball hits the frying pan again on its way down, and the whole thing happens over and over and over again until the balls run out of water. So you're hearing in the three segments, you know, you hear like the single clicks. That's one ball. Now here's a whole bunch of them. And now here's a truckload.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Same size frying pan?
Yeah, it was a pretty big size frying pan. It was really cool. You know, it just looks weird that the balls keep bouncing on their own. But now that
That's awesome.
Better idea what's going on. Very cool, noisy. Interestingly, I had a lot of guesses. One guy wrote in. He said, I think it's dolphins echolocating. I thought this was cool. Could be another kind of aquatic animal, I guess. Sperm whales, maybe. Do I need to know what they're saying? This was from Peter Sakuti. We did have a winner this week, and it was Tim Sims, and he said, I'll take dropping Orbeez water balls onto a hot frying pan for 500, Alex.
Hey.
Wow.
Yeah, good guess. I have a feeling he may have seen the video before.
Sure.
So moving on, I have a new noisy for this week. I found this one extraordinarily cool. I'm not going to give any clues because I think it's possible for a lot of people to figure it out, and you will find something you recognize here.
Your escape to reality. That's our show 1,000 years from now.
What is that? So send me your guesses. Send me any awesome noises you heard over the past few weeks to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Kara, what's the word?
The word this week was recommended by Lewis Goldberg, who is a listener and sent an email saying that he works in TV and was working on a show that involved multiples during pregnancy. And they started to research some of the crazier examples of that and came up with the term superfecundation. So superfecundation is a very interesting concept. This is the successive fertilization of two or more ova from the same ovulation, especially by different sires and or fathers. Obviously, this is something that can happen more often in animals that have litters. We see examples of dogs or cats having multiples and or a litter and having individuals within that litter being genetically distinct, meaning that some of them had one father and some of them had a different father. It can happen in human beings. It's incredibly, incredibly rare, but it can happen. And that is when there are twins that are fertilized by different sperm donors. I think it's happened once with a mix-up in an IVF clinic.
Whoops. A mix up. You ever want to hear that? A mix up in an IVF clinic.
Yeah. So that was probably not too fun for them. Actually, it might have been pretty cool because I'm sure they got a lot of media attention.
Yeah. There's been a little mix up.
Yeah.
Mix up.
Right. Whoops.
We accidentally impregnated you with tardigrades.
And so a related term to superfecundation is superfetation. And superfetation is specifically when there's a second conception during pregnancy, which is incredibly, incredibly rare, so that you actually end up with two embryos within the uterus that are two different ages.
Whoa.
And there are a lot of checks and balances in place to prevent this, but of course some of those systems do fail, and rarely you will see superfetation. So superfecundation was a very tough one for me to find etymology on. Obviously, I can talk about the word fecund, which is the root word, or fecund. Damn it! I did it! I knew I was going to do that. Okay. And so in my mind, I always wanted to say fecund, because that's what it looks like to me,
yeah,
F-E-C-U-N-D. Yeah. Fecund is a word that refers to fertility, and it comes from an early Latin term from the Middle Ages, which means fruitful, fertile, productive, rich, and abundant. And it does look like its root word, which is kind of interesting, goes back to suck or suckle, and that gives rise to rise to a lot of words that are similar, like filare is to suck, femina is woman, felix is happy or fruitful, fetus, of course, is offspring, phenum is hay, and maybe even filia or filius in early Latin, which are daughter and son. They all seem to come back to similar root words having to do with reproduction, which is kind of interesting. I was trying to find the first usage of the actual kind of clinical or zoological term superfecundation, and the earliest thing that I could find was in the reference section of a British Medical Journal article. There is a reference. H.E. Radish wrote an article in 1921 in the Surgical Gynecological Obstetrics Journal called Superfetation or Superfecundation? And that's the earliest reference that I could find in print. That's not to say that this person coined the term, but that was, in my digging, where the trail got cold. If anybody has anything from before 1921, I'd definitely be interested in hearing about it.
Cool. Very interesting.
Yeah. Fun word. Super weird.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Kara. We're going to do a quick email this week. Actually, we had a few people email. This is a follow-up, Kara, to your discussion about lightning.
Yes.
Yeah, we were discussing how to survive a lightning strike, and we pointed out that being inside a car is or inside any kind of structure is really good because it acts as a Faraday cage, essentially, and which keeps the electrical current or the voltage out of the interior. So you're pretty safe, you know, if you're inside a car and you're not touching anything on the, you know, anything conductive on the outside. Definitely want to be inside, not out in the open during a lightning storm.
Definitely don't want to be in a puddle of water.
Right. Don't want to be standing in anything conductive. And you mentioned the rubber tires and also rubber soles potentially being helpful. Then a few people pointed out that for a direct lightning strike, wearing anything rubber is of zero help, that's a quote-unquote myth.
Yeah, because if you get struck directly by such electrical force, it's going to, as we talked about, it's going to move through your heart.
A lot of the websites that talk about the fact that rubber doesn't protect you from a lightning strike pointed out that the air is fairly insulating, and you know another inch of rubber is not going to make a big difference, and also that the lightning is orders of magnitude more powerful and it will just overwhelm the little bit of insulation that rubber tires or rubber sole is providing for you. This is all correct. However, this misses the point of the discussion because they're talking about a direct lightning strike. If you get hit by lightning, yeah, you're screwed. No rubber raincoat, nothing's going to save you. Kara, what you were talking about was ground current, which is different. And
yeah, it's what killed all of those reindeer in, where was that, Norway? It was crazy.
Yeah. So I tried to find if there was any discussion about the efficacy of wearing rubber-soled shoes protecting you from a ground strike. And I could not find a direct discussion of that specific question, but I was able to infer it some things, I think, from reading a lot about it. Very interesting. So first of all, there's a concept called the step potential, and that is the difference, the voltage difference between one part of your body touching the ground and the other part of your body touching the ground during a lightning strike. So actually, most people who die from lightning aren't hit directly by the lightning. The lightning strikes the ground or strikes an object like a tree or a flagpole and then conducts current through the ground. And you can then get a shock through the ground that is strong enough to kill you. But the strength of that current is determined by the difference in the voltage between one foot and another foot.
Yeah, because that's how it, right? It comes up one foot, goes to your heart, and goes back down out the other leg.
So yeah, that's called the step potential. So the closer you are to the strike, the greater that difference, because you're obviously higher up the curve there. But also the farther apart your feet are, the greater the potential. So that's why, livestock, They are much more vulnerable because their legs, their feet are much farther apart. So even if they're the same distance, a lightning strike at the same distance through the ground could kill a cow but not a human, because the actual voltage difference could be a quarter as much for a person.
So having your legs farther apart means what? That the
it's
current
bad.
Has to travel?
Yeah.
No, it's okay. So you don't want to be doing yoga in a lightning storm.
Yeah. It's the voltage difference between one foot and the other. So yeah, you don't want – so you should have your feet right next to each other when you're standing, you know, and trying to survive in a lightning storm. You should put your feet really, really close together so that the voltage difference is decreased. And you also don't
– Yeah, which is kind of counterintuitive actually.
Yeah,
and not that like you would think to do triangle pose in the middle of a lightning strike.
And you also don't want to stand next to anything that's sticking up out of the ground because then –
Like a tree?
Yeah, like a tree or a pole or anything or on high ground. So you want to get away from it. So distance is your friend and feet close together is your friend. If you just think about it logically though, there is no amount of – you can't say, like, if you get hit with a lightning strike through the ground, you know, through ground current, that could be of any strength depending on your distance from the strike. And so the rubber soles will enable you to survive, you know, a little bit more. You know what I mean? It will decrease the overall conduction. So if you're, like, right on the edge of survivability, it may help you. It's kind of like wearing a helmet. In a motorcycle accident, it's not going to prevent any damage, but it will reduce it. So anything that reduces the conduction into your body would be an advantage. So again, a direct lightning strike overwhelms anything like this. But if you're, you know, 100 meters away from a lightning strike and you're getting ground current, things like putting your feet together, stepping, you know, standing on the soles of your feet so you have less contact with the ground, and having rubber soles, well, those things will all help. Also, not standing in water. You know, you want to
Don't do that.
reduce conductance, not increase it. Now, the probability that you'll be that the rubber soles will make the critical difference between survival and death is probably small. But again, you're just trying to increase your odds, you know, by as much as possible. But I couldn't find anyone like who calculated like how much it would help you or whatever. No direct discussion of that, but just wanted to point out for all those people who emailed us saying, no, that's a myth because it will overwhelm it. That we're talking about two different things.
Yeah.
Direct strike, yeah, it's irrelevant. It's the Faraday cage effect that saves you in a car. But from ground current, who knows? You know, it may help a little bit.
Yeah, there's a dividing line in the sand, like when you look at the ground strike mass deaths, right? When you see livestock that dies, you can literally outline on the ground where the deaths occurred. And then beyond that, the animals were safe.
Yeah.
Because, it only reaches a certain point. So if you were somewhere in that zone, maybe rubber would help protect you.
Maybe give you an extra 10 feet or something of survivability. Exactly. All right, interesting question though. It's always more complicated, right? That's one of our
right.
It's always more complicated than you think.
Well, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is Oatsy. You guys
what?
Know Oatsy? O-T-Z-I. Yeah.
The
Iceman? Sure. Hall and Oatsy.
What'd you say, Karen?
The Iceman?
The Iceman. That is correct.
Yay.
That is the nickname for the Iceman. That is the theme this week. Three facts about the Iceman. Here we go. Item number one. There is evidence that Oatsy was infected with Borrelia burgdorferi and is therefore the oldest known case of Lyme disease. Item number two. Oatsy had surprisingly healthy teeth, which researchers ascribe to his diet, which was high in fiber and low in sugars. And item number three. The Iceman has at least 19 living relatives in the Tyrol region of Austria. Bob, go first.
Borrelia burgdorferi. What? That's limes?
Lime.
Limes.
That's Lyme's disease.
It's Lyme disease. There's no S.
Oh, there isn't. No fuck. Yeah,
check your maths. Check your maths on Limes.
Like Alzheimer's and old timers.
That just seems. I mean, he's what? How many? He's like what? 5,000 years old? Shit, I don't remember. But it's a long time ago. Well before anyone ever heard of Lyme disease. Okay, let's look at the second one. Healthy teeth. Yeah, I mean, sure. High in fiber, low in sugars. I can see that. 19 living relatives. I don't know about that one either. The oldest. I'm gonna go with Lyme disease. I'm gonna say that's fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Ooh, Lyme disease. I don't know what to make of this one. Oldest known case of Lyme disease. I don't know. Is that the oldest known case of Lyme disease? Maybe in a person, but I don't know if we've discovered Lyme disease in other animals and things that are older than Otzi. So that could be possible. So perhaps that one's fiction. And then the healthy teeth, high in fiber, low in sugar. That makes a lot of sense, which means it could be the trick. And then 19 living relatives in the Tyrol region of Austria. I absolutely believe that that one is true. Well, I guess, I suppose I'll go with Bob, and I'll say it's the Lyme disease. It's not the oldest case of Lyme disease. It's they found it in some animal, probably, that's older than Otzi.
Okay, Jay.
All right, so this first one about him having Lyme disease, I wouldn't say, if Lyme disease existed back then, you'd think that most people would have it because they're outdoors. But I guess part of it too is like where in the world was the Lyme disease existing at that time? I mean, I'm in Connecticut and it's named Lyme disease because of Lyme, Connecticut, which means that I'm like close to patient zero.
Oh,
but I don't
you're
know.
Related
that's interesting.
To Otzi, then. Yeah.
I mean, I have no reason to think that Lyme disease hasn't been around for a long time and that, you know, this outdoorsman got Lyme disease. That's not that hard to connect.
Otzi the outdoorsman.
There weren't outdoorsmen. Yeah.
I love that.
There weren't many doors.
He gets an LL Bean catalog in the mail.
He was very folksy.
He enjoyed red flannel shirts.
Otzi in the healthy teeth. Now here's the thing.
Oh, you like
teeth,
Jay,
Yes, you know that I'm big on like dental hygiene and teeth and brushing. I spent a lot of time taking care of my teeth, going to the dentist, doing all this stuff, you know, the conveniences of modern technology. And I still get bad breath, and I still have to be very cautious about, you know, bad dentistry or bad, you know, care of my teeth. Things turn really bad really fast when you don't brush your teeth, floss your teeth, or do any teeth-like maintenance. So I don't think that anybody back then had good teeth under any circumstance. They all basically had horrible stinking holes that they talked out of and put food into. So I'm not even going to go to the third one. There's no way this guy had, quote-unquote, surprisingly healthy teeth. He probably had no teeth, if anything. So this one's the fiction.
You had to bring up flossing, Jay. Huh?
All right, Kara.
I don't know much about Otzi. I know that I had an editor back when I was at HuffPost who was obsessed with Otzi and published every story that he ever came across when he would read about Otzi. By the way,
I've heard somebody refer, we used to call it the HuffPo.
Uh-huh.
Call it the Puffho.
Oh, yeah, the Puffho. Lots of people call it that. The Puffho or the Puff Post.
Or
yeah.
I've also heard the Huffing and Puffington Post.
Oh, shit. And yeah, so I'm with you on that, by the way. Otzi was, what I do know about Otzi is he was a dude and he was like not a child. And so because he lived to a normal age, from what I've gathered, I would kind of agree that it's more likely that he would have contracted disease and it's more likely that he would have had bad teeth. I also think it's probably likely that he has living relatives because he's become a media darling. And I think part of that is because we know so much about him. He was a well-preserved specimen, but we've been able to study a lot of his connections, like his genetic connections. So I'm going to GWJ and say, he didn't have healthy teeth. He had an awful stinking mouth hole.
All right. We got an even split.
Gee.
And which means you all agree in the third one. So we'll start there. The Iceman has at least 19 living relatives in the Tyrol region of Austria. You all think this one is science, And this one is science. Good job so far.
Thank you.
So a little bit of background while we're talking about this one. The Iceman, also called Oatsy because he was discovered in the Oatsell Alps on the border between Austria and Italy, although Italy won the ownership dispute, so now he resides in Italy. It was discovered in September of 1991. A couple of hikers found what they thought was a hiker who had died and frozen the glacier, and it turned out to be a 5,300-year-old wet mummy. You know,
you were right, Bob.
Yep.
Yay.
The oldest wet mummy that we have. He has been extensively studied, probably the most studied mummy in the world. There's 100 scientists actively studying him. Basically, this is their career, studying this one body. So yeah, incredibly well studied. Massive window into this age, the sort of copper stone age is what they're calling it, 5,300 years ago in Europe. Yeah, so we've sequenced his entire genome. Oatsy's genome has been sequenced. There's also, researchers did a study where they asked for people in the Tyrol region of Austria to voluntarily submit blood samples. And then they compared them with these. Oatsy has a couple of rare mutations. And so if you share those rare mutations with him, you probably share a common ancestor with him. So these are probably not his descendants. In fact, it's possible that Oatsy was sterile. But in any case, there are 19 people who submitted specimens shared this rare mutation with Oatsy and then probably share a common ancestor with him about 12,000 years ago.
So Steve, was he sterile because he had Lyme disease and a stinking mouth hole?
So we'll get there. However, other studies found that his closest living relatives might be in Sardinia. And in fact, Oatsy may represent a population of Europeans that was widespread 5,000 years ago, but then has mostly died out or interbred. And only the Sardinians really are the sort of the only modern day remnant of the same race or the same population as Oatsy, which fits with the fact that for a long time, you know, researchers thought that the Sardinians were, of all Europeans, that they may be a really sort of ancient, isolated population. You know what I mean? Like going back thousands of years because they're on an island, you know.
Yep.
Sardinia and Corsica, I should add. Both.
Corsica, yep.
Yeah.
Napoleon was born in one and imprisoned in the other. I can't remember which is which.
Let's go back to number one. There is evidence that Oatsy was infected with Borrelia burgdorferi and is therefore the oldest known case of Lyme disease. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Carrie, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Never go
I don't
want to
hear you
Jay
gloating. Stop it.
Borrelia burgdorferi is the bacterium that causes Lyme disease, which is endemic to North America and Europe. And when they sequenced Oatsy's genome, they found a lot of non-human DNA. Among that was about two-thirds of the Borrelia burgdorferi genome. So he had a lot of that bacteria in him.
A lot. Do you think that's what killed him?
Well, no. We know what killed him. He didn't die of disease.
The arrow in the back, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the arrow in the back that killed him.
Gotcha.
It was funny. It's a side story. There's so many stories about Oatsy. One is that for years, scientists couldn't figure out the exact cause of death. He also had head trauma. The head trauma was probably enough in and of itself to kill him. But it wasn't clear if he got it in a fall or if he was hit in the back of the head with a rock. And then, I mean, like, so imagine these scientists staring at x-rays and CAT scans for years of this guy. And then someone says, hey, what's that? And there's a friggin' arrowhead in his back. And you could see it as plain as day. I mean, talk about inattentional blindness.
Yeah,
they just didn't see this damn arrowhead right in front of them. It's funny as hell. Anyway, so that the arrow, I mean, he was shot in the back. That's what killed him. There may have been other trauma associated with that as well. Okay, so he had horrible arthritis, though. And arthritis could be a symptom of Lyme disease. So that's another piece of evidence that he may have been. This guy was not healthy. you know. He was 45, by the way. And at 45, while he was probably physically fit because, you know, he was outdoorsy, right, Jay? So this guy was in the mountains, you know, in the Alps, was hunting up there. He had a recently eaten a meal of ibex, which is a wild goat, as well as a lot of the local plants. It was probably late spring, early summer when he was up there. He probably did not realize he wasn't on the run because he had probably a couple of hours before he died just sat to a big meal. So he was chilling, you know, it wasn't like he was running from enemies or anything. These guys probably ambushed him, or maybe they confused him for prey. Who knows? We don't know what the story is. They might have shot him by accident, but he was, you know, shot in the back is what ultimately killed him. And then fell face down in the ice, and that's how he was found 5,300 years later. So yeah, so Lyme disease was around 5,300 years ago. That's the oldest wow. evidence we have of Lyme disease.
Yeah, so there Ooh. You have it.
Lyme disease bacteria found in 15 million year old tick fossils.
It does say it's the oldest documented case of Lyme in humans comes from 5,300.
Yeah, yeah, in human of Lyme disease. Yeah.
Oh,
Lyme
wait, disease. let me reread the question here.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Therefore, yeah, it said case. Mm-hmm. It says case of Lyme disease in the question.
Case of Lyme disease, not mm-hmm. incidence not- of the bacteria.
What about Lyme's disease, though?
Yeah, that's actually, Evan, it's a little bit of a lazy headline. Ancient Lyme disease bacteria found in 15 million year old tick fossils. Yeah, it's not called Lyme disease until it infects an organism that it, and
yeah, the,
makes
the
it
Yeah, the ticks
sick.
Are a vector.
And they're just carrying the bacteria. They're not carrying the disease.
Yeah, I'll find so some animal. Kind of I'll find some animal that had it. Don't worry. I'll find
but,
it.
You know, go ahead. I mean, maybe this is what the researcher said. This is the oldest known case of Lyme disease. So.
Okay. Right.
But more interesting, you know, Kara and I won this week, right, Kara?
That's true. We won. Yeah.
Well, let's get to number two. Oatsy had surprisingly healthy teeth, which researchers described to his diet, which was high in fiber and low in sugars. That is fiction.
Nice try, Steve.
I added the second part to make it sound more plausible, and I totally mm-hmm. got Bob and Evan with that. I knew, Jay, I figured you would not buy that, though, because of your obsession with dental hygiene. So, in fact, he did have teeth, Jay. He had a lot of teeth.
I'm not saying he didn't have teeth, but there's no way that that guy had a healthy mouth.
He didn't. He had horrible teeth. He had an advanced case of periodontitis.
Ooh.
And in fact, in addition to finding the DNA from Borrelia burgdorferi, they also found DNA from Treponema denticola.
Whoa.
Which is a pathogen that causes periodontitis. And he had a very advanced case of it. He also had caries, right? He had cavities. And he had a couple instances of dental trauma. He had a couple of busted teeth. He had a front tooth that was cracked, probably because he fell on his face at some point in his life. And he also had a cracked molar, probably from accidentally biting down on a rock or something at some point in his life.
He must have been miserable all the time. Everybody
yeah,
back then must
exactly,
have been miserable
yeah, for
all
short,
the time.
Brutish, and nasty, right? I mean, so this is, at 45, this guy was done. He was riddled with arthritis. He had a horrible mouth of teeth. If that arrow didn't kill him, who knows what?
All the head trauma.
The arrow did him a favor.
All the Lyme disease.
It was a mercy killing.
Well, he would have obviously died eventually of inhaling totally nasty air that was getting just, you know, his teeth and mouth were smelling so bad. That smell could have killed him alone.
So, Jay, if you're shipwrecked on an island, is that like the place where you go in your head? Like, what are my teeth going to be like on day three? And you just can't.
Jay, you remember.
You basically shut down at that point.
Castaway, where he has to knock out his own tooth.
Oh, yeah. Nasty stuff, man.
Yeah. Brutal. What I love is you guys watch period movies, right? And it's like, you know, whatever.
Sure.
600 AD. And you're looking at people in their 40s and 50s with perfect teeth in perfect health.
That.
Yeah, like perfect skin. And it's like, no. These people would have been wrecked. They would have had boils and bad rotting teeth and they're, you know, with no modern healthcare.
Lesions all over the
place. Yeah, those who even survived that long would definitely not be in good health.
Right. Yeah, it's so good when the directors actually think about that and give people bad teeth and make them look really dirty and sick. Like, because it's more realistic.
He has got shit all over him. Exactly. I definitely like that hyper medical realism. I like to feel like in a period movie that I'm being transported to another time and place. I'm seeing modern Hollywood actors playing, medieval characters, it kind of loses something, you know. Right.
So this is a good time to remind our audience, please rinse with a fluoride wash, okay?
Jay, I thought you were going to say this is a good time to remind them to become an SGU member.
I thought so, too.
That would have been nice, too.
And get more important content.
Rinse with a fluoride wash. Listen, it takes 2 minutes out of your time. You know when I do it? I brush my teeth in the morning, and then the time it takes me to walk downstairs and get ready, like my final exit to work, there's your 1 minute of rinsing. That's it. Spit it out in the sink, and you go, and you're good.
Jay, you got that one coworker who just like really needs a mouth overhaul kind of?
More than one. Oh, my God. I mean, it's like literally the place is riddled with people that are dentally compromised.
A bunch of Oatsies all over the place. Yeah,
I work with a bunch of Oatsies. That is going to be my nickname for anyone that's got stink mouth. Yeah.
Like, all right, Oatsie, back it up a little.
Back it up 10 feet. Board with
arrow
those
in
teeth,
their back.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going as Oatsie to Dragon Con next year.
That would be awesome.
Oh, let's do it. I'll be
with an arrow in your back. You gotta have some freaking
and the teeth coming. and a big tick sticking out of my head.
A giant prehistoric tick. All right, Evan, give us the quote.
This quote was suggested by listener Andrew Engel from Plano, Texas, or as I like to call it, Plain Old Texas. Plain
you guys, that's where Texas. I'm from.
I used to live in Dallas, Texas for a little while in my life, so Plano
was
not
born and raised
far.
In Plano.
Nice, hi, nice. Hi. That's where the South Fork Ranch was for the show Dallas.
It's true.
So, Plano, Texas. So there
who
you
cares,
go. In any case, this is not about
sorry,
Texas.
That guy was really exciting for me. I was like, oh, I lived there till I was 24.
Cool.
Go ahead.
Very nice people there. And Andrew submitted this one. To know that we know what we know, and to know that we do not know what we do not know, that is true knowledge. Written by Nicholas Copernicus.
Oh, nice.
Nicholas Copernicus. Well, in this case, this is the known knowns versus known unknowns, right? Mm-hmm. And the thing that gets you in the ass is the unknown unknowns, is the things we don't know,
that's right.
Which is the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Mm-hmm. It's the idea that we're not aware of our own level of ignorance because you don't have the knowledge to gauge your own ignorance by definition. So you basically have to assume that you are a lot more ignorant than you know yourself to be. Right?
That's
almost
hard for people
definition.
To do.
Yeah, so I think Copernicus is saying that real knowledge is having a good understanding of what you don't know.
Right, your own limitations. It's
And it's hard it's hard to do because that shit goes deep.
It does. Absolutely. Yep.
All right, well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Oatsie.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
Ha ha ha.